Mental Health Monday
on Radio City Talk
with Mick Coyle.
Tackling the stigma.
Radio City Talk.
My name's Mick. I do hope you're well. Thanks for joining us for this live edition of Mental Health Monday, episode 100, direct from the steps of the iconic St. George's Hall on Lime Street in the heart of Liverpool city centre. We're spending the day looking at lost childhoods. We're looking at the issue of children's mental health at the start of National Children's Mental Health Week. We're also taking a look at the figures which say that 226 young people were lost to suicide between the ages of 10 and 19 in the year 2017. We've been meeting some wonderful organisations that are doing their best to put children on the right footing from a mental health point of view. We've also spoken to parents who have lost their teenage children to suicide as well. Absolutely heartbreaking stories, but stories which fill us at Radio City and Radio City Talk, and people like Jake Mills from Chasing the Stigma, with a sense that something can be done, that help is out there as well. Jake set up the Hub of Hope, which allows you to basically find mental health services close to where you are simply by putting in your postcode to a website. And then he thought, I'll make it even easier, and now it actually just uses the location thing on your phone to find the services very close to you. Jake is with us throughout the course of the afternoon. Jake, it's great for you to be here. Jake and I did the 24-hour mental health marathon just over a year ago. Jake, what we did with that is I did a lot of prep for the show, and then I then delivered a bit of the prep, and then you just torpedoed the whole thing and said, forget all that, Mick. What we want to talk about is the fact that everybody's got mental health. But I have picked out some stats and facts here, which I just wanted
to run by.
No, absolutely. Now, this is a really important one. It's one of the reasons why Children's Mental Health Week is such a key thing, that 75% of mental illness can begin before the age of 18. And if you can therefore take action at a very young age, these aren't then issues that have to bleed into adulthood.
No, and what it's all about is preparing. You know, you look at school, you look at nursery, you look at preschool, you look at primary school, secondary school, university. What that's doing is that's preparing you for life. Well, that's what it's meant to do. By not having mental health as part of a curriculum or even a conversation within those years that are meant to be preparing you for life, you're in turn not preparing people for life. And you know, it's no surprise to me that would be the case, because that's where our minds are developing and becoming who we are, and that's why it's absolutely essential that this is where the conversations start in school. It doesn't have to mean that you're talking to young children and toddlers about suicide, but it can be talking about your mental well-being. You know, mental health at the moment generally by society is seen as a bad thing. It's seen as a negative thing. If we were to go out and ask any of these people describe a word, it would be a negative. Whereas we should be turning that completely around, and we should be talking about mental health as a spectrum. You will have good mental health, you will have bad mental health, you might get mental illness. It's preparing people for what to do in those cases.
50% of mental illnesses, are actually established by the age of 14. So we talk about ages there, that people might be a bit, you know, maybe should we have this conversation? Are they too young? There might be an age which is too young, but I don't think there's any age which is too young to talk about how you feel. If we're talking about established mental illnesses by the age of 14, we are talking about a much earlier intervention than people might consider.
Yeah, I think there was a really interesting point made by the staff at YPASS before about, you know, not feeling equipped. And they said everyone is equipped. We just don't realise, and it's being able to identify that you are, because I think it's things within us and conversations and points to look that actually we all, it doesn't have to be this really intense conversation. It can be just part of that everyday life and everyday conversation.
And if we are going to bury our head in the sands, we need to kind of be aware of the consequences. The consequences of which are laid out for everyone to see here in Liverpool city centre with suicide as well. But, you know, if we talk about walking a mile in anybody's shoes, we don't have to be talking about suicide, do we? We could be talking about a million and one different things, which, even if suicide is not part of the issue, we can be, you know, look at young people's lives there, which are ruined, which are stunted, opportunities they don't get because of mental illness.
Yeah, and it's this idea that every single thing that you do, mental health awareness, is suicide prevention, because that's the crisis point, the end of the line that we want to prevent people from getting to. I just to kind of break away a minute though, Mick, because we're stood here today, and what we're meant to be doing with the shoes is we're meant to be engaging people in having a conversation. As we're stood here now, there's was about 8 people who were stood around taking pictures, looking at the shoes. But by having even the traffic warden there, by having the likes of the Papyrus workers around here, the amount of people I've seen who've asked the question, what's going on? And when they've got the answer, actually, it's about they've engaged in that conversation. They haven't backed away. They haven't said, oh, actually, I don't want to talk about that. They've actually engaged in it. And I think the Papyrus workers, each have spoken to everyone who's asked them for a good few minutes at least. That shows that there is appetite there to have the conversation. We're just giving people the reason to have it.
Also, I asked them to get that traffic warden just
discussing
because the Radio City vehicle over there, I don't think we'll put a ticket on it. That's not our problem at the moment. It's Radio City Talk. It's episode 100 of Mental Health Monday. We're going to be meeting a series of young people and talking through some young people. I'm also going to replay you as well a previous episode of Mental Health Monday where I spoke to a young girl who wrote an essay about mental health and shared her own story. You're joined now on the programme, though. I'm very pleased to say she's with us. As I get my piece of paper in order, you're officially a young person. Sophie's with us on the programme. Thank you for your time, Sophie. Great to see you. You're working with Papyrus now.
Yeah. I'm a suicide prevention advisor for Papyrus. I work on the helpline.
You're obviously inspired to do that because of your own mental health journey, if you like. Firstly, can I ask you about the work you do? How fulfilling do you find it? Because you must have some tremendously difficult conversations.
It does have its moments. It's really difficult, but it's so rewarding as well. We work on Helpline UK, which is a suicide prevention helpline. So we get to support young people with the thoughts of suicide, as well as the families of people who are struggling as well. And we also get to go out and deliver training as well in the community, universities, colleges. So it's a really rewarding job.
Being young yourself, you're from a generation that's kind of grown up in the same generation that young people are now. I think sometimes when you've got people who are a little bit older, they're looking back and they're a little bit nostalgic about their own childhood.
Yeah.
I don't quite get how the world works now. Is the world a very different place now in 2019, the start of 2019, than previous generations experienced?
I think some of the same pressures I had when I was growing up are certainly still here, but I think there's a lot of added pressure as well now for young people. I think they're in an adult world a lot earlier than other generations. Certainly that had come into place when I was younger, but maybe not as much as right now.
Do you get a sense of that? Is that something that comes up in conversations? Not that they're saying, oh, it's an adult world, because to them, I guess, it's just their world.
Yeah, absolutely. They've not known any kind of different world. But there's those added pressures. There's, you know, social media now, so people don't always escape the pressures from school. When they go home, they're there. My sort of generation was slightly on the back end of that. It wasn't quite as intense as it is right now.
How much of sort of young people's life is taken up by the technological side of things? There's been a couple of news stories recently about young people, the amount of time they spend on Instagram and the impact that it has. Is that a fair reflection? You know, you get this sense about screen time, that young people are constantly on screens. Is that the reality?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a lot of young people do spend a lot of time on social media, but I'd just like to add in as well, there are some positives that come through that. There's certainly people I speak to, the only friends and support they have are through social media, through sort of networks, through support groups. So there is that side to it as well as something that is positive also.
Tell us about why you were keen to work with Papyrus. What was it about your own journey that made you want to get involved?
Okay, so my sort of struggle with my mental health started from when I was really, really quite young. I struggled with anxiety and low mood from a really early age, and sort of to avoid situations that I found difficult, I would think about ending my life from when I was of primary school age. For me, this only got more intense as I went through teenage age, and I actually turned to self-harm as a form of coping and attempted to end my own life as well when I was in high school. I did go through services. I had quite a difficult time through services, but I had a really difficult time in school as well, because I just don't think the understanding was there. There wasn't the same sort of awareness around mental health that we're seeing now. Things like today, it's brilliant. But back then, there was no sort of policies and procedures in place in the school that I was in. So my mum took quite a lot of that on herself and actually put quite a lot in place through speaking to schools. and I did disengage from services and sort of found my own way to manage. And I think that's something really important, that yes, do seek help, please do reach out, but the more self-aware you become, the more you learn about your own mental health and sort of develop your own coping mechanisms and skills, that's what will really sort of benefit you moving forward with your mental health. It's not always about recovery. For a lot of us, we might not make a full recovery. We might struggle with our mental health throughout our adult lives as well. But if we can be self-aware and sort of learn our own triggers and learn what helps us to cope, then during those really dark times, we'll have ways to sort of see us through until sort of the light comes back again.
In terms of, you mentioned primary school there, and I think a lot of people listening would have done a sharp intake of breath. Are children thinking about that? But the 200 pairs that we've got here, the 200 pairs of shoes, there's a proportion of them are children from the age of 10.
Absolutely.
That we're talking about as well. And again, we talk about the right age to start talking to young people.
Yeah.
Young people are already thinking about these things. Some young people are.
Yeah.
We need to have like an adult response to that, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah. I think children understand a lot more than maybe we think. And there are ways that we can certainly talk about suicide and mental health with young people that isn't, you know, frightening or scary. If we have a look at sort of in this country, the amount of time we spend in physical health education, the amount of time spent on mental health education is not on par. If we have that awareness from an early age, I certainly think that's something that would have helped me to understand my own mental health, recognise those signs and know where to go for support would have been really positive. I certainly think we're heading in the right direction, but there's still quite a long way to go.
When you have a conversation with people, by the way, young people, when they hear that you've had an experience, are they like, oh, right, oh, I can talk to you about this then? Because, you know, we talk about making connections with people and speaking to the right people. You strike me as the perfect person to speak to young people.
Yeah, I mean, on our helpline, we won't focus on our own experiences. That's about that young person. But certainly when I'm out in the community or out training, I have spoken to young people who have told me that they've attempted suicide. And I think when you explain, like, that you've been there as well, you've come through that, I think that can be, you know, really positive to see that, oh, and now you work and you support people with
suicide. I was going
to
say, what is that reaction? Do they kind of go, all right, and you, yeah. And you're here,
yeah.
And you're talking to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think hopefully it gives a little bit of hope that you can come through the other side of this and maybe not make a full recovery where, you know, everything's completely fine now and you no longer have any mental health struggles, but perhaps that, okay, you can live with this, there's ways to manage this, there's support out there and you can do this.
I was keen to sort of get that message out there as well when we spoke to the Young Person's Advisory Service. I said to them, what, you know, what does it look like at the end of a series of therapy sessions? Because, you know, there'd be a hope that your child goes skipping out of the door and everything's absolutely fine. That's not always the case. How have you found sort of moving into sort of adult life, if you like?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a case of it's done forever. Therapy and counselling can certainly have a brilliant effect, and for some people that can be the end of it. You know, that can be exactly what they needed. For other people, it might be something that you need to go back to and have other sessions. I've certainly continued having mental health support as an adult. I've sought therapy as an adult when I've needed it, and that's okay. You know, each sort of session, each sort of journey in counselling and therapy is something new and something different, and that's okay. I think it's just about managing those expectations, that it's not going to change overnight. You know, mental health recovery or managing your mental health is hard work, but it's doable.
Where's your journey going to take you next?
Working for Papyrus, and that actually really helps me with my mental health as well.
Not just working for Papyrus, doing wonderful work working for Papyrus.
Thank you.
The link to the Hope Line and also how people can access services through Papyrus is up on our website at the moment. So I'll just mention that, radiocitytalk.co.uk. And the Papyrus team have come down, I'm going to say more pandered, that's the phrase I'm going to use today, with explanations of what's going on. If people are stopping, they're having conversations. You've got your banners here, you've got a little marquee going and everything like that as well.
Yeah.
So if people do have questions and want to pop down in the next couple of hours, they can come and have those conversations.
Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Really appreciate you coming on the program today. Thanks for joining us for episode 100.
Thank you.
You're with Radio City Talk. It's all about lost childhoods. That's the issue we're discussing today for Children's Mental Health Week. Sophie sharing her story as well. We've heard some amazing stories as well. People have been so brave in talking so openly about what they've experienced, what they're going through. A couple of months back, we were looking at the issue of self-harm, and I spoke to a young person who had been affected by mental health issues which were leading to self-harm. You can listen to the full episode as part of episode 85, I think, of Mental Health Monday. But I'm going to play you a clip now from a young person, I'm not giving out the name, who has experience of self-harm and negative mental health. She started off by sharing an essay that she'd written on that issue.
Imagine if society blamed people for being diagnosed with cancer. Just imagine claiming it was a life choice that's led to such a terrible disease. Horrifying, right? Imagine putting the added burden, that shame, onto someone who is fighting for their life. This happens every day, and each day is a constant battle between that person and their inner self. So it isn't just victims of cancer, but victims of mental illness too. The fact that one in four people suffer from some sort of mental health, whether that's depression, anxiety, or some sort of disorder, such as a mood disorder or an eating disorder, this stigma causes severe harm by dehumanising those who have mental disorders, making it harder for the mentally ill to admit their symptoms to others and seek treatment, as they may feel ashamed and alone. Don't you think it's already hard enough? This is a very common problem worldwide. A death by suicide happens every 40 seconds, so even during the speech, innocent lives are being taken away consistently. It's not because they want to die, but to end the pain within.
I mean, that sets it up very nicely for us, and well done for that. I thought you were absolutely excellent reading that out as well. You're very young, but obviously, you know, touching on suicide and being aware of suicide as an issue as well, these are sort of adult themes, if you like. Do you get a sense that even at your young age, these are things which you feel the need to be clued up about and maybe other young people need to be aware of?
Yeah.
And in terms of putting those things, writing them down, when you started writing them down, did you find it to be almost a good experience putting it down onto a piece of paper to sort of getting the thoughts out of your head, if you like? What was that like, writing it?
It's kind of always helped me with my mental health issues because I suffer from it. And writing it down and how I feel has always been easier for me to actually express to someone, like saying it how I feel. So by writing it down, it just helps because it's not like a face-to-face conversation, really.
In terms of your own personal journey as well, you talked about your own mental health. Where for you have been the issues that you've found in life so far in terms of your own mental health? What problems have you been living with?
It's just the fact, really, about my parents' divorce and my granddad passing. I've been bullied at school, and that's kind of all like led up to about my mental health. And it's just, and it's like social media as well. You see all of these like women and all younger women, like the perfect body figure, really. And that just makes me feel as though, well, maybe that's what I need to look like. And it's just made me feel completely worthless within me.
Do you feel like sometimes you get bombarded by those sorts of images?
Yeah. Because it's just social media in general. It's like pressurizing younger people. And like just not even younger people. It's older ones as well. Like just everyone in society makes them just feel pressurized. Like, oh, that's what you need to look like. Because if you don't feel good in the eyes of the media, then you're just going to feel completely rubbish everywhere else.
Do you feel like the issues that you've faced in life have caused, have kind of put you into this kind of corner, if you like? Do you feel like those issues have led to this kind of situation and the way that you view the world? Because actually those issues that you live through, you know, other people will go through, they'll react in different ways, won't they, as well? Do you feel like very much that you become the victim of those circumstances, if you like?
Yeah.
And in terms of how it manifests itself, you touch on self-harm within the article that you've written as well. At what point, at what age was it that you first considered doing that?
Well, I first cut myself when I was 6 years old, and that was during my mum and dad's separation. But it also continued from year eight, like midpoint year eight, because of like bullying. And obviously because I was suffering from when my granddad passed, because that happened when I was 8 years old. And my mum never really gave me like a chance to grieve over. So that didn't help. Plus, obviously, with the bullying and everything, it just came back to me. And obviously, self-harming has then been a thing for me, how to cope with my feelings inside.
Six is such a vulnerable age for you to have been considering self-harm, of an act of self-harm at that age as well. Maybe gives people a sense of the issues that you were facing at the time. Was there a sense that you maybe weren't able, there wasn't enough people around you at the time to maybe tackle some of those issues at that age, and that led you self-harming once again when you got to that year 8 period, which I'm guessing you will be 12 or 13 years of age?
Well, when I was 6, obviously, because my nan and my granddad at the time were too focused around the stuff between my mum and my dad, I didn't really want to make things worse or anything. And then, obviously, when I was in year 8, again, I still didn't feel like I could tell anyone. It's just something I've been embarrassed about. So,
in terms of reaching out and putting things down, have things changed as a result of this? Has this been sort of, have adults been sort of made aware of what you're going through to the point where actually they're looking to offer you some help?
I am under CAMHS at the minute and everything seems to be okay, even though it was like a rocky start at first. I have been to the doctors and the hospital. Again, that didn't really help, but doctors was the ones that referred me to CAMHS. So let's just see how things go.
Do you feel like there could be more help available to you?
There could be a lot more help, really. A lot more.
And in terms of your school environment now, your educational environment, have they been kind of made aware of what you're going through? Have they been able to sort of help you out in terms of your journey?
Student services from my school have helped me quite a lot. It's like a safeguarding team. So they have helped me a lot through mental health. And I have spoken to the school nurse quite a few times, but that was like probably back in year 9. And I was seeing a youth worker that did help me. That's like more of internet safety. So I'm not saying I haven't had the help, but I'm saying that they could do more.
And in terms as well of, you know, the situation that you found yourself in, I guess people might have been able to look at your situation and think, well, this particular person might be vulnerable because of their experiences. Let's make sure that we are, you know, speaking with that person and finding out a little bit more about their environment. It seems that a lot of what you've been saying is reaction to self-harm, reaction to your mental health, whereas actually it's not been about safeguarding you from an earlier point of view, of spotting potential signs and actually making a connection with you sooner. Is that something that you'd like to see, that there's sort of greater screening, if you like, of young people who might be at risk of self-harm or of mental ill health?
I do think that self-harm and mental health does need to be more like seen in the outside world, because obviously people, like, because you can't see it physically unless if someone who does self-harm isn't afraid to open up, then you don't really know it's happening, so people just tend to brush it off the shoulders as though it's not there. So maybe if like there was more like screening in the worldwide and people on social media helped or whatever, maybe celebrities even could come out and do stuff about mental health, then maybe it might be more of a topic there was talk about, and then people who do need the help might approach it a bit more.
Yeah, and you wonder whether or not that's going to come from the social media companies, or whether or not it's going to come from the schools, or whether or not it's going to come from the government. But from what you're saying, it's quite clear it's got to come from somebody.
It's got to come from somewhere, just to start.
And in terms of yourself, at the moment, you're in the CAMHS system, but obviously you're looking for more help as well. Is this something, your mental well-being, that you're looking to pursue? That idea that, you know, you want to get yourself to a better place, that you can't change the past, but actually you're in control of your own future.
Yeah, I have been told you can't change the past, but you can learn from that to help with your future, really. But I do really want to be like completely like change from my mental state at the minute. So probably like when I'm older, I want to become a journalist, which I want to help more with mental health. That's what I want to do.
Well, I can tell you it's a wonderfully fulfilling job if you get into journalism, particularly when you focus on mental health. And I think that actually, if it is something you set your mind to, I think it's a path which you'll find wonderfully fulfilling as well. In terms of your aspirations for the future from the situation you're in now, do you feel like you're going to be a completely different person in a few years' time? Have you got a sense of hope that the pathway that you're on is going to take you to a different place?
At the minute, not really. I'm not going to lie, I just don't, at the minute, I don't see anything going anywhere at all.
And do you feel empowered enough to be able to let those people know that maybe the pathway you're on isn't the right one for you, and to maybe explore other pathways, or to ask them to help you explore other pathways?
If I had the guts to ask, probably, but at the minute, I'm just trying to like just see what they can do first until I can step in and say, this isn't helping, I need to do something else.
Papyrus are doing wonderful work down with us today. We've got their CEO, Jed Flynn, with us on the programme. Jed, thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being part of today as well. Your team has come down and haven't been able to do enough for us, including biscuits, by the way.
We're doing this for the young people of Liverpool and beyond, who many of whom will have to struggle day by day, often with thoughts of suicide. And it's something that no parent, no adult wants to countenance, but Papyrus, those who founded our charity, know only too well that the loss of a child to suicide is an unimaginable horror story. And it doesn't just impact the immediate family. The ripple effect can be cataclysmic and intergenerational. So my message today is very simple. If you see this on social media, share it. If you are in the city of Liverpool, come and see it. Stand alongside. Stand almost in the shoes of the young people who struggle every day with thoughts of suicide. Our message is one of hope. We can help to save young lives.
This image was very much inspired by the work you were doing with the class of 2018. When we spoke to your team as part of our 24-hour show, you had a very striking image, not a dissimilar tone to this, with a school photo with simply no pupils on it.
Yeah.
Does it sometimes take more than words? Does it sometimes take an image to set a thought in somebody's mind?
It's a very powerful image to see an empty graduation photograph. And I took that to my friend who's a head teacher in a big secondary school. And I saw on his wall graduation photographs, class of 15, class of 16, class of 17. I said, could you put this empty graduation photograph up? And he said, I'll have to think about that. I'll have to speak to my leadership team. And therein lies the problem. Nobody wants to countenance this reality that suicide is the leading cause of death in young people in this country. And government and all of us need to wake up and do something new about that. Talk about it. Nobody died ever by talking about suicide. But keeping silent kills us.
And for parents as well who are listening to that, who've thought, right, I've spent all that time talking about how my child needs to cross the road. I've done all the stuff about stranger danger. I've done everything now within my power to try and keep my child safe. But actually, you just laid it out bare there, that the biggest threat to them is actually suicide.
Themselves. A woman told me that she'd prepared her child for university. She'd packed condoms in his bag. She'd prepared for the ultimate horrors that she thought about. And then he took his own life. And she said, in retrospect, I covered every option apart from the one that was most likely to kill him himself. I think you're absolutely right. Sadly, this only comes home to us and changes our behaviour when it affects somebody we know. When people stop at our stand today, they often say, thank you for being here. That happened to me. That happened to one of mine. Most people who walk by will be like me. People who've not been touched by suicide will walk by. But when you've been touched by suicide personally, that, like I have, it suddenly becomes a message of hope that a charity like Papyrus exists, that this display, although it's horrific at one level, showing children's shoes of those who are no longer here, it's also a sign that we believe passionately in this city of changing that for future generations.
We've heard from parents who've lost young ones to suicide, and I very much get a sense that they've not done anything wrong. But as parents now, and as society, how can we do things right?
You mentioned earlier about taking your children across the road. Sometimes you need to send them across the road. And resilience, I always think, is a balance between push and pull, give and take. I think one of the campaigns we've been involved in recently in national news has been protecting children from themselves and others online and the social media world. It's all pervasive. And I think our message there has not been one of stranger danger, but really to get the young person to think about their own responsibility online. So a message to parents today might be to have a safe conversation with them, not only about online dangers, but also about emotional health and well-being, to open that conversation with them.
Absolutely. We've seen a very high-profile case, really, of a young girl lost to suicide. And subsequently, you know, when they've gone through the back catalogue, if you like, of web searches, Instagram was flagged up at this particular case. You start to piece things together and get a sense of a hidden world that child was in that as an adult you wouldn't have been aware of as well. there's always that sense that, that children get to that age, 13, 14, 15, you want to give them a little bit of their own private space as well. You want to give them a little sense of, well, you're getting a bit older, so we'll do something within a safe environment through a tablet. What harm could come from there?
Yeah.
But there are clearly some serious harms that are still out there.
I haven't got a quick fix for any parent. It's a very delicate balance, allowing a young person to explore that new reality that adolescence and adulthood is for all of us. But I think something you said made me think of this, that a lot of our young people, the danger is not just that they're surrounded by social media fiends who are trying to take their freedom away or get them in danger. I think one of the realities that many of the young people who contact us on Hopeline UK every day is that they're isolated. They may be surrounded by friends on Facebook and Instagram followers to beat the band, but often they're isolated because they're not in a society that freely talks to them about suicide. So if they're thinking about not being here anymore, they protect everybody else from that horror by keeping it in, and so they almost isolate themselves, but actually it's society that's isolating them, because it's we who create stigma. It's you and I who create stigma every day by refusing to talk about death and refusing, in fact, to talk about suicide. So we need to change that and talk openly and honestly about suicide.
Is that why you at Papyrus, based over in Warrington, are so keen to bring people into the Papyrus family who have first-hand experience, that I think they call it lived experience now, of these incidents?
Papyrus is often referred to as a club that nobody wants to join. A mum standing only 100 yards here shared a story earlier of losing her 14-year-old son. That's something that I think gives our charity its lifeblood, that personal experience of loss is our raison d'etre, that we want to stop young people getting to the space where her son did, where he felt that suicide was an option. And we want parents never to experience what she sadly has, and many, many more like it. So although we're a club that nobody wants to join, when people come alongside us in what we euphemistically call the Papyrus family, people do very quickly say it's a place of hope. It's a place of life. It's a place of opportunity to share stories that in turn will protect future generations and keep them well.
In terms of those numbers that we're talking about, 226 we're looking at today in terms of these pairs of shoes, I mean, if that number came down significantly and it was, quote, only 105, we'd still be talking about 105 lost loved ones. We'd still be talking about, if that came down to 35, if it came down to 15, if it came down to 10 or 3, there would still be so much work to do.
If that number was one, and that number one was yours, you would do everything to protect life. And if there were only one pair of shoes on there today, I'd still be here saying we need to do all we can to change the public discourse about suicide. Why do we keep it on a top shelf, hidden from view, so that nobody can talk about it when they're experiencing thoughts of suicide? If only this was as common a conversation as, where are you going on your holidays? What are you having for your dinner? Have you thought about suicide? Once we get to that place, there'll be many fewer shoes on those steps.
You've got some fantastic work at Papyrus. Hopeline has been mentioned a few times, actually. That might be new news to some people. Just explain about how it works and how people can get in contact with it.
So back in 2005, parents were asking our charity, how do I know the difference between a teenage strop and somebody who's behaving in a way that may lead to their suicide? How do I know when somebody's suicidal? And the quick answer to that is you don't until you ask. But it's much more difficult when it's one of your own. So we started Hopeline back in 2005. We now open every day from 10 till 10, weekends 2 till 10. We offer professional advice from mental health qualified staff who are all trained in specialist intervention skills. You can ring for yourself if you're under 35, although we'd never discriminate if you're over that. And if you're worried about a child or a young person who may be having thoughts of suicide, contact Hopeline UK on 0800 068 4141. And if you forget that number, just look us up online, Papyrus, and contact us there.
And there's a full link on our website, radiocitytalk.co.uk. Jeb Flynn, thank you for your time and thank you for sharing your story. The wonderful work that goes on at Papyrus UK, based over in Warrington, operating nationally, but of course we're very much part of their world today down at St. George's Hall as well. They've joined us for episode 100. We're going to talk about the positives between now and the end of the programme and what action we can take. Unfortunately, that does mean speaking to politicians. We're going to be speaking to a few of them on the programme today. Lib Dem Councillor Richard Kemp is with us. Richard, thank you for your time.
A pleasure.
You
and
have
the
been
insult.
Absolutely. Yeah. You have been involved in the national strategies around suicide prevention. If people think people aren't talking about this in the corridors of power, they'd be wrong. They are, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. 2 weeks ago, I spent a Tuesday in the House of Commons talking about suicide and the Wednesday in the House of Commons talking about suicide. Last week, I chaired a conference about children's mental health and the problems as they transition from children to adults, where there's a fragmented service. And next week, I'm going to meet the Minister for Suicide. And that's an important development. There's now an understanding this is such a problem, not only children's and young people's suicide, but generally, that a minister has been appointed to look at this. So, yes, it's very much the topic of the moment.
That's Jackie Doyle Price.
That's right.
Yes. Interesting to see what comes from that meeting. The stakes, as we can see from the shoes that we've laid out to represent the ones that we lose to suicide, the stakes are so high, aren't they, in regard to this?
Well, what we must remember is that what we're seeing here, and what a lovely graphic way of presenting a serious problem, is just the tip of the iceberg. For every one of these pairs of shoes, there's at least 1,000 young people with a mental health problem. And it's also the tip of the iceberg. In that if we don't deal with the problems while they're young, a lot of them then go on to have more serious mental health problems and commit suicide afterwards. For example, one of the suicide events that I did was about gambling and suicide, and I was talking to the parents of a 24-year-old who developed his addiction when he was 16 on these fixed odds betting terminals, which fortunately are going to be closed from the end of March. And there are some appalling statistics nationally. 40% of all the young people that we know have a mental health problem aren't dealt with by anyone. So it's rather like saying, oh, we think you might develop flu, but come back when you've got flu and we won't give you some tablets now. We're just not dealing with the things early enough. Now, the government has produced a strategy. It's a long-term plan for the NHS, a 10-year plan. It actually launched in Liverpool last month. And they talk about prevention being better than cure. It's better for the health service. It's better for the individuals. And, of course, it saves a shed load of money, because if you can deal with the problem early, then it doesn't become a big problem, which involves mental institutions, psychotic drugs, and even more serious problems.
Do you get the sense then that this is the generation, and I mean the generation of society and of politicians, who are going to take the steps that does have a positive impact 25, 35 years down the line?
Well, first of all, it's important that we remember that some of the things we see today will only appear in the statistics in 30 years' time. These are long-term health issues, whether it's this or obesity or other issues. The trouble is the words are all there, but frankly, the money isn't. Now, I don't think money is the answer to these problems, but there's also no answer without money. We need to join up services better. As I said before, we have a cut-off point of 18, so you're helped by one lot of people till you're 18, then another lot of people after, which means from about 17 and a half, the young people looking after you, so young ones start drifting off, and they don't pick you up till 18 and a half, a really serious year. Now, I didn't say to my wife, I'll look after the kids till I'm 18, you look after them afterwards, because that's not the way a family works. So certainly we ought to be covering that gap. And the way to deal with that is to deal with families as a whole, to support schools more. There's some evidence that a lot of schools exclude people with mental health problems because they ruin their statistics. And we need to do more in the community as a whole to support people with mental illness problems.
From those meetings that you had, though, what does that look like? What does that positive work look like?
Well, it actually involves time and effort, and that's what you need the money for, to provide the time. Imagine yourself as a teacher with a class of 35 with a child, perhaps two, if you look at the statistics, with mental health problems. You're trying to then deal with 33. You've got to get them through their SATs, through their exams. You don't have the time, even if you know there's a problem, to actually address those. So not only do we have to give the teachers time, we have to create the links between, in this case, the schools and the health service or the other organisations like Papyrus, to make sure that that help is given. And it's got to be upfront. If you leave it till it's too late, then it literally becomes too late and you end up with 226 pairs of shoes.
I'm always impressed by the work that takes place both in Liverpool and across the northwest of England. You've been in London there. Are conversations like this taking place in Birmingham, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Bristol?
Well, there are 152 councils with social services responsibilities, and 150 of them have a prevention of suicide strategy. I actually think that Liverpool is one of the leaders in this. There's always been a very strong link in Liverpool between the health services and the council services. Could it be better? Of course it could. There's always more you can learn. There's always more than you can do. But I do think this is a problem that is now being recognised. Not only the suicide, which is, as it were, the apex of the problem, but the child mental health issues more generally. But not all of that can be dealt with by money or practical help. Some of that needs legislation. I mentioned before fixed odds betting terminals. How do you advertise a range of products, a range of activities? We need a proper debate on what controls there should be, on what young children can access through social media and in terms of gaming. I mean, I was reading something yesterday about how we effectively train people to kill people, murder people, fight wars and become prostitutes and take drugs. And that's what we have games to do. Well, they don't sound like games to me. So if those things aren't taken to extreme, I mean, perhaps there's, we always played war games. I used to go around with a little gun thing when I was seven. But now the influences on young people are much greater than they were when I was a boy.
Councillor Richard Kemp, thank you for your time today. Thanks for joining us on the programme. Liverpool City Councillor Barry Kushner joins us on the programme now. Barry, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
I know you work so hard to sort of focus on children and young people, many different aspects of their lives as well. Liverpool has been set aside as one of the trailblazing cities to come up with a new strategy to help children in regard to their mental health. It's a new strategy, but it's a simple strategy, right?
I think the idea is that we create provide services at local level, really, to within communities and link to schools so that young people can gain access to them. So the idea is simple. I think putting into practice is going to probably be a bit more complicated. But yeah, we have some good practice in the city, Y-Pass Plus, and the programme that they rolled out 2 years ago that was partly cut last year, unfortunately. Yeah, well, hopefully we can rejuvenate that and add some resources into that, because they know what they're doing a good job.
And actually that feeds into a part of the conversation we've been having today, which is that although politicians and MPs can make decisions, it's about how this then filters down. And actually it's up to people like you at the local level to deliver it, working with those organisations who know the areas, who know the communities, who know the kids.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, I was just talking to Jake before, there are thousands of people in the city who work with and support young people who've got mental health problems, and they're their friends. And yeah, we need to galvanise that network, and also their parents and their families. And we need to galvanise that network and help them and give them some advice and information and allow them to talk through things so they can understand how issues are evolving and developing. And we can do that if we organise things properly on a community footprint. And that is where you sort of try and get that help to young people a bit earlier, and probably when they're not really realising they're getting it.
I almost get a sense, though, at the moment, that grassroots movement, grassroots community, we've seen with Papyrus, NYA, who've been here today, Young Persons Advisory Service, that movement's
ready to move. It's ready to mobilise. Yeah. It's already mobilising. And I think sometimes if you're then waiting for that funding to come down, that's where the frustration is. Because I don't think there's any parent who's thinking, well, you know what? The responsibility around my child's mental health lays at the hands of the health minister or the suicide prevention minister. I think people want to take action on this, but it's about everybody being together.
It is. And I mean, problems with children's mental health happen in the community, don't they? They happen in at home, they happen in their daily lives. So that's the place where young people are. And of course, you need specialist services as and when you need to make those interventions. But having that support around them in your daily life is got to have a much bigger and greater impact than just putting everything into specialist services. And I think that's where we need to really make a change.
In terms of access to services as well, that's absolutely crucial. Yeah. Signposting, we were saying today that, you know, got links up on our website as well. For parents who need, you know, direct action and they need communication, because for a lot of this, parents will be going through this for the first time. They won't understand some of the phrases. They won't understand some of the issues that get raised as well. So that communication is so crucial, isn't it?
It is. And I've seen close friends of mine with their children have gone through this and of course you get your treatment or you work with specialist services, but then you've got to go home and then you're still trying to deal with the issues that a young person has. It might be going through different psychotic episodes or different episodes where the mental health is really badly affected, and they're trying to deal with that on a daily basis. And I think that's where we really need to provide a lot more support as well. So of course the access to those sort of specialist services, all the way up to, you know, to the CAMHS that we offer through Alder Hey, for example, is really important. But there's a whole lot of young people before we get to that stage, and that's where we need to provide the effort really. We don't want young people to get up to that stage where they're so sort of critical and their mental health is deteriorated to such a point that we're fearing that they're going to be a harm to themselves or to other people. And I think, and that's where we need to really, so we need to apply a lot of effort at that sort of community level, I think.
How much of a priority is the work that you're doing within the City Council? Obviously, it's a priority for you. Is it seen by the City Council as a priority? The stakes, as we see today with the number of shoes that we've got laid out, are very, very high.
Well, they couldn't be higher, could they? I mean, if you were talking about, you know, with child and young people suicide, the stakes couldn't be any higher than that. But it is a priority for us, and we're having conversations, and I am with the clinical commissioning group, and I'm pleased that they now recognise that it's a priority, not just mental health for adults, but mental health for young people. And I think they do recognise that now, and it's very important. We've got to get this right.
And of course, in terms of that, we mentioned an austerity and funding has been mentioned a few times on the programme. For you, from a local government point of view, to be able to say, well, look, help us invest in this to save money. I mean, it's a very clinical way of looking at it, but if that's the business that we're in.
Saving lives, Mick, as well, isn't it? Saving lives and saving people's healthy lives. You know, we know public health will tell us that 75% of adult mental health issues begin in childhood or when people are young people, and half of those young people have got no idea that they're going through these problems. So if we want to have a proper preventative agenda, we've got to focus our energies and our attention on young people. Got to do that. And so it's an absolute priority for us. So yeah, of course we can talk, it will save money, but it's about saving young people, giving them their best start in life, and trying to make those, help them work through issues they have that they're finding difficult to understand with the young people, so that they've got a platform for when they get into adulthood and the rest of their lives.
Barry Kushner, thank you for your time today. Thanks for joining us on the
programme.
Thank you
for spending time on doing this today.
Hey, not a problem at all. Not a problem at all. That's Councillor Barry Kushner from Liverpool Labour on episode 100 of Mental Health Monday. We invited a number of MPs down to the programme today, among them the Wavertree MP, has been a strong campaigner on the issue of mental health. As a result of everything that's going on in politics at the moment, Brexit. She wasn't available to be with us here at St George's Hall, so I caught up with her just before we came on air, and I started by saying that this was absolutely worth investing in, that we have to focus on the investment in children and young people to make sure that we can improve their lives and improve their lives now.
It really does, and we know that the overwhelming majority of adults who have a diagnosable mental health condition will have developed it as a young person. So for all those young people that are affected, but also the impact it can have and could have on them into adulthood for decades, is why it's so critical that we really focus on doing something about this issue.
And the evidence appears to be that if you do take action at a young age, it can make a real difference. Politically, though, is it too long-term a project for politicians to really want to support?
Well, on the face of it, we hear some really warm words from government. So, you know, the government clearly is alive to the issue about how serious it is, and specifically in the worst case examples that, you know, too many young people are tragically taking their lives. But it's about actually putting plans in place that are going to have a proper effect. And I sit on the Health and Social Care Select Committee, and we have interrogated the government's plans for the next more than 10 years until 2030. And we were told that this would be, they called it the transformation of children's and young people's mental health. And yet our conclusion said that it was going to let down a generation. So what we see is lots of warm words and political support, but in practice, and I can't answer the reason why it is, and there's lots of different reasons people believe, but in practice, what the government are proposing isn't actually going to make the difference that we urgently need to see.
But in terms of spending money, and if, you know, we're talking about a government where austerity has been on the agenda for quite some time, but, you know, recent statements aside, that if we're going to save money in regard to this, and if we're going to make it about money, the lesson still stands, the issues that you raise. If you invest in young people, that saves you money down the line. You're not dealing then with adult services, adult mental health services, to the same extent. So it would make sense at a business level, wouldn't it?
I couldn't agree with you more, Mick. And, you know, the financial case and the economic case is incredibly robust. I mean, I'm motivated first and foremost about the moral and social reasons why it's important to support young people early on, to keep them well and to intervene wherever possible and to prevent wherever possible. But yes, of course, you know, the costs speak for themselves. If someone is in a critical situation, then that is always going to cost the system more. And it just, in my view, doesn't make sense that we've seen so much of the prevention work, so much of the early intervention work stripped out, because that's only making a difference to the cost ultimately of people being very, very ill later on.
Obviously, the issue of social media has been raised a lot topically in the light of a high-profile death recently and the way that young people deal with the digital world as well. I guess many people listening today, Luciana, may not have obviously had experience of the way young people live their lives now in that digital and social world. What's been your experience in regard to what young people and organisations who work with young people have said to you about the prevalence of social media and technology in their lives?
Well, we've definitely got a job to do to sort out the negative impacts of social media and being online. But let's be clear, there's also many positive aspects of it, and actually the opportunity for young people to engage and to access support in a confidential way is really, really important, and to get peer support as well. So, you know, as much as there's some negatives, there's also positives as well. And actually reflecting on the evidence that we heard at the Health and Social Care Select Committee's inquiry into this, it was very clear from the young people we heard from, and from teachers and from professionals, that even if we solved all the issues to do with social media, we're not going to adequately fix the issue of young people's mental health. So it's certainly an important element to address, and I welcome the fact, for example, we've heard this week that the head of Instagram is coming to speak to government, because there's a whole issue, there's a number of issues there about the images that are being shared on that social media platform, for example, images around self-harm and, you know, some very serious images around mental health. But even if we took those away, that isn't going to solve the crisis of young people's mental health. And this is as much about a social justice issue. You know, a young person from the most deprived background is four times more likely to suffer with their mental health than a child or a teenager from the least deprived background. So, you know, there's many other issues at play here. You know, we need to be looking at poverty, for example, to adequately contend with the crisis I think we see today in our young people's mental health.
I was going to say that might be one of the things that people have picked up from today, that we're not really talking about a medical issue, you know, when we're talking about children's mental health. When we're talking about risk factors in particular, we are talking about social circumstances as well. And that's why politicians really have to play a role. We can change our mindsets on mental health, but actually we're talking about things which governments and politicians can legislate over.
Well, yes, and I'm part of a cross-party parliamentary group which is looking at the impact of adverse childhood experience on young people's mental health and their physical health as well. What is adverse childhood experience? It's a combination of different factors. It's precarious homes. It's living in a home with a parent that might have a substance misuse issue. It might be the death of a parent or a parent that's in prison. It's neglect or abuse in the house. And any combination of those factors we know is, according to research that's been done in recent years, is going to have a very detrimental impact on the life chances and the health outcomes of that young person. So if we contend with those issues, and again, it starts from conception right through childhood into adulthood, then we can make a massive difference. And we need to get more politicians alive to these very serious issues, and again, to tackle the problems at source.
Speaking more generally now, Luciana, how do you think people's attitude toward mental health has changed? I mean, we've been doing the show for the just over 2 years now, episode 100 today. I get a sense that it is much more a mainstream issue. That was the challenge from yourself right at the start of it. There's still a long, long way to go, though, isn't there?
There's always progress to be made, but I think we can celebrate the progress that we have made thus far. We can look at how societal attitudes have changed, that it is coming out of the shadows. We haven't fixed all the issues around the taboo that still exists around mental health and the discrimination that we know people face. You know, we've still got a job to do, and particularly for older generations as well, there's that generational barrier as well that we have to overcome. But we're certainly making a lot of progress. We're talking about it so much more. And again, my job as a politician and the work that I do in Parliament is to translate and to essentially make a difference to this. We've had this political commitment to what's called parity of esteem. It's enshrined in law and was done so back in 2012. It's supposed to mean that we should see equality for mental health. I'm trying to close that gap between the rhetoric and the warm words that we are increasingly hearing and actually the action, translating that into action that we can tangibly see, where we do treat mental health in exactly the same way that we do physical health. And that, for me, is a gap that we still need to close.
Luciana, thank you for your time. We'll see you at episode, we'll say 150, but we'll book you in for 200 as well.
Well, thank you, McKinn. Congratulations to you and your team for all that you do, because it's a really important part of the national conversation. And I'm glad that you've been honoured nationally for the contribution that you're making.
And thank you for your part in that, Luciana Berger. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mick.
Into the last 20 minutes or so of the show, it's episode 100 of Mental Health Monday. I'm looking at producer John now. He's going, I've got to carry all these shoes home with me first and foremost. Jake Mills is with us from Chasing the Stigma. Jake, it's great to have you on board. I think the messages that we tried to get out and we're keen to get out, we've got out so far, right?
It's continuing to do so again. You know, I think at every single point of the day today, there's been people talking, taking pictures, and engaging in our conversation. It's happening now. People of all ages. I think there was a point earlier on as well where we had a little girl who was walking in between. But then I don't know if you've seen, but there seemed to be a school class who walked past as well at one point as well. And it was kind of, again, it's that bringing it to life and that reality of what we're trying to get across here.
Apart from the fact that my voice is absolutely gone.
How did you last 24 hours?
So I last Christmas we were going to do the 24-hour show, and I thought, you know what will happen? I'll get ill and I won't be able to do it. Or I'll have a cough or a cold, or generally I'll just make a mess of the whole thing. And it ruined last Christmas for me. So this year I'll do, let's do something much more manageable by doing the shoes thing. And producer John Fogarty, who's new to the programme as well, took up the challenge incredibly, as Lizzie did last year with the 24-hour show, and really made a difference. And I thought, you know what, I can do a 4-hour show, because I do a 4-hour show every day anyway. I'll be fine. Yeah. Then my little girl, she got a bit of a sniffle. Then my little lad got a little bit of a sniffle, and he spent 2 hours in our bed shouting overnight tonight. You know.
And then I get a text off you last night. Or this morning, was that? Last night?
It was last night.
Saying, just so you know, I've got a cold. I'm not feeling very well. So here we go.
I wanted you to think, oh, he's going to drop out and make me do it all on my own.
Which, you know, I was prepared for, but I'm glad that you're here.
The, in terms of the preparation, I'm wearing like long johns and everything because it's been about minus 15. I was walking through snow yesterday and it's actually been a really glorious day. So people who've come down and taken photos, St. George's Hall looks amazing in any weather, but on a day like this, it's a really special place.
It has. It's helped because, you know, you've got Lime Street there. The people are automatically looking over to St. George's Hall when they're coming out to Lime Street. And I think people have been attracted to come over and to see what we're doing here. And I mean, there'll be pictures everywhere, I imagine, from the amount that have been taken today. And if this can just be, I don't know, maybe this can happen in other parts of the country and we can kind of get that point across.
Yeah, and thank you, by the way, to Bernardo's for providing the shoes today. You know, wouldn't it be great if, you know, Manchester City Council said, oh, could we have the shoes to put on display outside the town hall, in Birmingham City Council, in Glasgow, if we could take these shoes down to the Palace of Westminster and lay them down there to try and hit home. Because one of the things that struck me, and somebody approached me before and they were in tears, they'd seen the image and they got a bit upset but wanted to see it in real life, and broke down in tears when they saw it. And they said, you know, for all the words that you can use to see an image like this, it makes a real difference.
I think looking at social media as well, that's been one of the key things that have come over consistently from everybody. Is I think I've seen it about over 10 times already where people have said, why is this not a public outrage? Why am I only seeing this now? Why are we only being made aware of this because of what you've put together here? And, you know, there's a lot to be said in you taking that kind of that challenge and doing that for people. But it's true and it's right. We shouldn't be hearing about it just because we've put these shoes out here. Everybody should be aware of these figures because it affects all of us, and it's not going to go away anytime soon by just brushing it under the carpet.
Yeah, and I guess as well, you know, as we move into adult lives are very complicated as well. We spent many times on Mental Health Monday talking with services that provide suicide prevention strategies, treatments, whatever it would be, places like James's Place, Paul's Place, and we've had those conversations. There's a, when it's children though, you suddenly think, wow, because I think people, even if they don't know much about suicide, might understand scenarios around suicide. When we talk about suicide and young people, suicide and children, you know, we had a guest on, didn't we, talking about the fact that she was thinking about suicide when she was at primary school. That's almost beyond comprehension for so many people.
It is, and I think it's something that people feel. I mean, we know that people feel uncomfortable when talking about suicide anyway. And to even try and imagine that a child is going through those thoughts, I think part of you is angry at that, and I think we've heard about anger today quite a few times, but then part of you, it's so sensitive, it's so upsetting that almost people go, I don't even want to acknowledge it, I don't even want to talk about it. But we can't be like that, we can't carry on like that, because the number of these shoes are only going to grow if that's the way that we carry on. And I think from every guest that we've heard today, from the services to the service users to people who have experienced things themselves, they're all saying, let's do something, let's actually address this, let's not be awkward about it, let's actually go out there and face this head on.
Absolutely. And of course, those people who've shared their stories today, Carmel and Sarah at the start of the programme, the young people that we spoke to and have heard from as well, if they can talk about it, then we can talk. If they've gone through the worst possible thing you could imagine that could happen to your child, and they have the strength to say, right, we can do something about that, then that's up to you and me and parents and society and teachers and whoever comes into contact with anyone within society to say, right, well, we can do something about this. The conversations are out there. We can join in those conversations.
And we can do something about it. You look at the work that Papyrus are doing, you look at the work that MYA are doing, you look at the work that YPass are doing. They're just three examples. You look at the work that Carmel's doing, the Oscar Phillips Foundation. They are examples of how you can make a difference and how you can do something. And it's just about engaging them. It's funding it. It's funding the services. The government need to be funding the children, the adolescent services properly. And we need to be getting that help and support out there, real help and support that's going to make a difference, because the more and more awareness that we do, the more that we need those services. It's not about pointing and blaming the likes of social media, although it does play a role, but it's about saying, well, how can we back this up with actual support?
And we already knew a lot about Papyrus and the work that they did as a result of conversations many times that you or I have had. I've been hugely impressed by them today in terms of what they brought to St. George's Hall with them, the number of people on board, the work that they do with Hopeline UK as well, the fact that they're a national provider based up in Warrington as well, so they've got Northwest Twist as well. So keen to share their own stories as well, so keen to be part of it.
They are, and I think given the line of work, given what it's about and preventing suicide in young people, given the fact that they have a lot of people who have been affected by that themselves and experienced by experience, it doesn't come across in the sense that they're not kind of, for want of the word, wallowing in that. They're positive and trying to change other people's lives based on their own experiences. And I think everyone who will have come in contact with anyone from Papyrus today will have got that happy, positive experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And what great work to do. You know, if you say that your focus in work on a day-to-day basis is preventing the suicide of children and young people, what greater work is there than that? But I've used this phrase a few times this afternoon and through the morning as well when we started. The stakes are so high. The stakes are so high. If this was a malaria bite, if this was an infection, if this was a human being that we were talking about taking these lives, there would be social outcry. There would be riots on the streets. There would be newspapers demanding answers. There would be politicians demanding answers. And yet this is happening now. You know, 226 young people. There's only 190 school days in a year. I mean, the number is awful. And even if it was half, it would still be awful. Even if it was a quarter or a fifth, it would still be a terrible set of figures, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and the thing that we need to remember is all these numbers, all these shoes here, all those lives that were needlessly lost. Suicide is preventable. It's preventable. These lives did not need to be lost because it was preventable, and we need to be taking action, and it's not. Although this is great that we're doing this, it needs to be more than just us, because it is preventable and we can be doing more. We can.
I want to say a few thank yous to everybody who made today happen. Papyrus, we've mentioned as well. Merseyside Youth Association, YPAS, who came down as well. Plenty of great organisations. Local councils who came on board as well from Labour and the Lib Dems as well. And Luciana Berger, who was joining us a recorded interview, but from a little bit earlier on today. Chasing the Stigma is Jake Mills' personal charity as well. You've been offered a biscuit, Jake.
Oh, yeah, go on. I'll have a biscuit. Thank you.
I'm all right. Thank you. Also, John Fogarty, who's worked very hard to make today happen, today's producer, Hannah and Holly, who were taking care of the shoes as well. When we came up with the idea for doing the show, I wanted to run it past Carmel. In fact, Jake will tell you, because I gave the idea to Jake to say, do you think if I mention this to Carmel, then she'd respond positively. Carmel joined us right at the top of the programme to share the experience of losing her son to suicide. Carmel, today feels like it's got a message out there. Do you feel that same way?
Yeah, I do. I think it's brought it to life, like, you know, to so many people that can connect with everything that's being said on the show today. Yeah.
In terms of the conversations you've had as well, because we've got the Papyrus team on and various different people who've kind of come in to show their face, have you found it that helpful? Have you found that a positive environment to be in?
Yeah, it is. It's lovely seeing so many people working so hard to try and break all this stigma down and, you know, stop the seed from growing, if you like. We don't want these trees that are going to be collapsing in the future. We need to cut them down. We need to stop it now. And that's, I think, everything that we're doing is helping. Yeah.
And if we talk about stigma in regard to that, and it's why, you know, you sharing your story, Sarah, as well, in such an incredible way that I almost think that if people are thinking, oh no, people don't want to talk about it, people are afraid or unsure about talking, if you guys can talk about it though, if you guys are saying let's talk about it, we should be listening, shouldn't we?
Yeah, definitely should be listening, and everyone should be talking about it, because it's life, it's happened to us. And I always thought that things happen to other people, because my life was so normal. I didn't have anything traumatic happen to me. That we had a normal home, you know, everything was so just perfect in some ways. I did feel blessed with two children, and I used to look at my two children and think, I'm so lucky, I've got two children, a boy and a girl. I feel so blessed, and I cherish my Never once did I think that anything was going to happen to our family. And if it happened to our family, it can happen to anyone's. So we do need to talk. Everyone needs to have these discussions around like family times.
And actually, you mentioned the word. It's strange how many times, Jake, it's come up today. Normal. That people aren't looking for exceptional circumstances. People are looking for normality. And that's who we want to reach as well. People who have, quote, normal lives. Because it might be them who find themselves in the middle of a situation like this, like Carmel's story. And then what steps do you take? What action do you take?
Well, that's exactly the point, is that we are not being educated or prepared to know how to deal with situations that we're statistically probably going to go through at some point, whether that is on the spectrum of not feeling good or being actually mentally ill or going through any kind of form of mental illness. We're not being prepared for that. We don't know the steps. We don't know what to do. We don't know how to handle it. We don't know how to talk about it. We don't know where to turn to help. That's not good enough. That's simply not good enough. And again, by putting out today, and I have to say, Mick, you now have, you've done 100 shows of Mental Health Monday. I remember when we first spoke about doing show one. What you've done last year is you've done 24 hours, groundbreaking stuff. What you've done today is you took it out to the people. You and the team and John and Lizzie in the last one as well, you've shown how easy it is. You really are. I'm not saying you're doing the simple things, but you've
John
shown
just
how
raised
easy.
His eyebrows. He found 200 pairs of shoes.
But you've shown how easy it is to actually just do it. Just do it. Get on with it, and put it out there. And that's two examples now of going above and beyond what anybody else is doing, and it's just a day of work for you, and I think that you deserve all the credit in the world, and you as well, John, for actually putting something together like this, because it is making a difference.
I think thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. I think there's something to be said, Carmel. You know, these are slightly, feels like we're living in new times now, that the old rules don't apply politically, whatever. But I almost think that people will start to say, well, what were you doing? If it's about climate change, if it's about mental health, if it's about politics, I think people will maybe look back at this generation and go, well, what did you do? And I think if we can all say, well, I did this, or I tried to start this conversation, or I started this foundation, or I set up this charity, or I just simply spoke about it. I think that can be, I'm not saying we'll sleep more comfortably in our beds, because these are not always comfortable times as well. But I think you can do things at many different levels. And I think speaking to people on the program as well, from episode 1 to 100, sometimes it's only when they've had the worst experience, Karma, like yourself, that a world will open up to them, if you like. And if we can let other people know about that world in the hope that they never have to get involved, and I think that puts us mainly in a positive place, doesn't it?
People need to open up and speak about it. And I know it can be difficult, because especially if you're going through a traumatic experience right now. When I was grieving, as I mentioned earlier, I felt quite angry that other people hadn't stood up and spoken about it, because I was thinking the more people that can help and stand up and talk about things, it's going to save the future generations, and it'll help other people who are struggling, to be able to just talk about it. It is okay. It's okay to not feel okay, because that's normal as well. You're going to feel up, you're going to feel down. Hopefully what you aim for is to stay in the middle and then just have these little ups and downs, but that's what we have to learn to acknowledge in our bodies. We are whole. We're not just a body and mind and a physical, but actually everything, body and mind, is together. And that's what we need to sort of teach in schools as well, of how to look after ourselves and how to look after our friends and family around us. And as a mother losing a son, I feel completely guilty. I go through all the emotions of guilt, thinking I let my son down because he's not here. I wasn't a good mum. How could I not see that? But it wasn't there. I've got friends who are doctors. I've got another friend who is a counsellor and the teachers in schools. Nobody, Isabel, my daughter, she is so, so close to her brother. And she said, why didn't you tell me? There was 10 and a half months. They were almost like twins. But they were the closest siblings that I know of as well. And she didn't see a sign. So you think it needs to be opened up. People need to feel, just say it. Just say, do you know what? I don't feel okay. And then that's all you need to start the conversation, saying, I don't know what it is. I don't feel okay. And then we can open it up then.
Carmel, we think you're absolutely wonderful. Thank you for being part of the show today. Thank you for coming on board, and thanks for joining us for episode 100 of Mental Health Monday. If you've been affected by any of the issues on the programme today, up on the website as well, radiocitytalk.co.uk. We mentioned, you know, speaking in public, and Jake, I know this is a big thing with you. It's not about just, you know, people don't have to come on the steps of St George's Hall and, you know, and share their story as well, but those resources are out there. Those charities do work. You do work well in regard to this, where people can go on those websites, read up on it, just educate themselves on it as well. They might find a little in which might help them on their journey.
Yeah, there's a big difference between speaking to somebody and speaking publicly, and it's still private, still personal, it's still your health. You don't have to publicly announce it as long as you speak to somebody, as long as you seek support, that is there.
Jake Mills, thank you for your time. Hubofhope.co.uk if you want to find local mental health services close to you. That's hubofhope.co.uk. Episode 100 of Mental Health Monday. Thanks for being part of it. A lost childhood specials from the steps of St George's Hall, the iconic St George's Hall in Liverpool City Centre.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle
on Radio City Talk.